issues. So we're starting a new recording 11 now. I was just giving a brief overview of why we would study philosophy, and one of the reasons that I think it's valuable to study philosophy is just for this bringing to the surface the fact that our whole culture is actually steeped in a certain set of what we would call philosophical presuppositions that the culture, if you like, lives in. And one of the purposes of studying philosophy for me is to bring those to light, so that in some sense you're not just living under something. Sheila, come in.
Sorry, I'm late.
Come in. Find a chair and squeeze up, I think, is what we'll do. It is. What happened? Why didn't it work?
Put it in.
Just slam it up again. Yeah. Yeah.
Does that mean we've got the projector?
I think it means we've got the projector, but we'll carry on regardless until everything's in place. All right, I'll put that back in.
Yeah.
Now I'm safe, unless I walk out of here with the key, in which case I'll never be allowed back to teach again. Yes. Nicolette's going to remember the key if I don't.
We'll write it down.
Yeah.
Key.
Yeah.
I dare pause the recording because it seems to...
It seems to start all over again if I try and pause it. So if anyone's listening to this, my apologies. We're fiddling about with the projector.
Fast forward.
A cable or two. Are the cables all in there as well? Yeah. Oh, this looks like a new projector. Is this...
This is the FUB projector.
And if it goes walking on my shift, then that'll be the big end of this, this career. Extension cable. Oh. Got everything. I think we can do the rest. Except to... Can we get the screen out of the other room? Yeah. Do we need 2 pound candles? I think I'll need my 4 hours this week just to set up the lecture material. Come on, Epson. Looks like it's ready to plug straight into my Apple now. Isn't that a rare thing? The world's converted to Apple. Oh. How to change the signal, Wes? I haven't used this one before.
This projector?
Yeah. Oh no, it seems to have woken up by itself.
Automatic.
Just need to press the enter key. So
I think you can put a book under the...
Yeah, I'm just seeing how far back I'm getting so that we get a nice size. So, yeah. To the image.
Does anyone have that?
We'll just use one of these. Good?
Mm-hmm.
They're doing funny. All right. Those of you on the recording, the technology is now in place. We've got Eagleman's video, you know, his program. That's just the beginning of the program. The sound's not going to be good. I mean, it's the best I can do on this machine. So I don't want to distract everyone too much with that because I hadn't finished talking. I was somewhere in the middle of, yes, this bringing to consciousness this these background assumptions that in many ways date back to the scientific revolution. And that's not to say that everything started there as if there was a clean slate. You could say that what happened in the scientific revolution was laid on top of a medieval kind of Christian understanding. That I wouldn't say that we left that behind either. It's a bit more like archaeological layers. It's like the science was laid on top of this Christianity. In Europe, I'm talking about. But I'm particularly interested in Europe because the European scientific revolution is intimately tied up with the kind of globalization that we're living under now. So we're just in some ways tracing the roots back of a certain understanding that has now become gone global. So at a certain level, I think studying philosophy is just a matter of becoming, instead of having a certain understanding imposed on you, you become aware of where it came from and that in some sense it's relative, but it's not relative in the sense that you can say I reject it because it this is my understanding again. To a certain extent we just live together in a society, and the collective understanding of that society is a kind of an environment in which we live. And you can't just say, I've got rid of it. It's still operating. And it operates at a level that if you manage to separate yourself from it in any significant way, which in a way I think is, for me, that's almost the definition, one of the definitions of being a philosopher. In a certain sense, you do isolate yourself from the world. But another way, if you want to say it in a brave way, you become an individual as well. But by isolation, I mean it becomes more difficult to, if you like, subsume yourself into that collective understanding. For me, it's almost unbearable to watch the media. It's almost unbearable. Unless it's good fiction. I don't mind fiction, but when anything purports to be telling me something that's true, I find it, but I'm getting to be like one of those guys on the Grumpy Old Men programs as well. You know, you reach a certain age, don't you? I don't know, not all of you have, but yes. I digress a little bit there. So, the course is Philosophy of Consciousness Part 2, but it has a subtitle. What was it? Science, Consciousness and the Brain. That's right. So its deeper intent is to take this understanding that comes from science, which in itself is very convincing. And that's what I hope that when I gave this as a kind of a task to watch the documentary, that I didn't want you to fight against it. I wanted you to actually, if you enter into it, it's like entering into a world that in some sense is self-consistent. It's not as if Eagleman's telling lies, and it's not as if Eagleman is trying to deceive anyone. He's actually endeavouring to get across what he's learned from his research, and what he's learned from his research isn't false. So it's not, it's more subtle than that. And the idea really was, after having taught everyone phenomenology for weeks and weeks, to suddenly throw that at you and say, well, do you see that what we've been doing studying phenomenology in some sense doesn't fit with that documentary? As long as you're studying phenomenology, it's almost like you enter into a self-consistent world where you're reading Husserl, you're reading Heidegger, you're listening to me give lectures, we're talking about it, and it all seems to make some kind of coherent sense. And then the idea is you look at the Eagleman documentary, and that makes a coherent sense, yes? And you say, well, that's good, that makes coherent sense, my studying of phenomenology makes coherent sense, but what I want to say is the two clash. Yeah, the two clash. And in a way, Eagleman isn't there saying, well, this is how what I say connects with phenomenology, and the phenomenologists are not saying, well, this is how I say connects with modern science. I mean, Husserl and Heidegger did mention it, but it was never their intent to try and harmonise what they were saying with science. And also, science has moved on tremendously since they were writing what they wrote, particularly brain science. So my idea, and this course is the first time I've taught it, so we'll have to see how it goes. My idea, in a way, is to do that very task that Husserl and Heidegger didn't do, which is to say, well, if we really go and we look into brain science and what it has to say, how can we square that up with phenomenology? Do we just have to, in some sense, reject what science has to say? Surely what brain science has to say should be deeply informing to phenomenology. And there are people who think that. It's not just me. So there's an area in cognitive science and people in cognitive science who think that there is a significant, that phenomenology is highly significant to brain science. However, there's always a but with me, isn't there? The people in cognitive science who think that phenomenology has something of value to say in the study of brain science are still essentially under the sway of that very mindset that I was talking about. Mindset, I don't really like that word. The set of assumptions that inform empirical science are also informing the viewpoint of the people in cognitive science who think that phenomenology has something of value to say. So it gets rather complex. Do you see there's a complexity there? Where I would say, from where I'm coming from, that they haven't really got the deeper philosophical import of what phenomenology has to say, because the deeper philosophical import of what phenomenology has to say really can't be made consistent with what the people in cognitive science call naturalism. And there are deep cultural reasons for this too, because I know that world to a certain extent, and they're not complex. Naturalism is a deep respect for empirical science, and if you don't show a deep respect for empirical science, to put it bluntly, you're not going to get research money. Unless, of course, you're in philosophy. But I'm talking about the people in cognitive science. Yeah.
Can I just say, is not one of the problems that actually to get to the level where you have that experience and understanding of
of empirical science at that level, of to be a cognitive
scientist, let's say, yes,
is like a lifetime study, and to get to the stage where you're at with philosophy is like a lifetime study, and we don't have many people who are able to combine the two. So you almost have to have an understanding of both. But if you're training through the scientific method, you're spending years and years and years working through that.
Yes.
Often, as you say, with philosophy completely excluded, or you're coming at life through a philosophical idea, and it takes years and years to get your head around a lot of the philosophical ideas.
Yes.
So we reach the end of life, later stages of life, and often we disregard what people say at the end of later stages of life as
yes.
being not so valid. And
yes.
For people who are mid-career, and that sort of combining these ideas, and I don't think this is just particularly actually in this sphere. I think in a lot of spheres, a lifetime isn't long enough to reach the understanding that we want.
So can I put it in a? You've caused me to think, put it things in a slightly different way. You're right in what you're saying. The people doing cognitive science,
indoctrinated in that.
Yes, but it's not really even indoctrination. It's like this collective understanding, which we all sort of share, which is deeply informed by science. Is when you specialise in a certain area, that's really. You just accept that collective view because you haven't to overcome it involves just what you say
a diversion that
yes.
takes you another lifetime.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
That's the situation that we're in. Looked at in another way, is that collective understanding that our sort of culture our global culture shares is. I think a short word for it is it's now inadequate, in that it doesn't, it's inconsistent with the actual knowledge that we have acquired in all our specialities. Do you know this? It's not. It was, in some sense, it was fit for purpose in 1700. And the nature of these ideas, despite the fact that science thinks in terms of continuous progress and everything's changing all of the time, these deeper ideas don't change. There are levels that don't change. But it's becoming increasingly obvious, even on the surface, by the surface I mean to ordinary people, that in some sense or other, the way that we're going about things here is unsustainable, which in a way is expressed in the ecology movement, for example. But it's, we can't carry on in the way that we're carrying on economically. There are some people who think, yes, technology's going to save us. Yes, technology, that we're going to have such brilliant ideas that the whole process of globalisation is going to be, all the problems that are imposed by globalisation is going to be fixed by. So it's not as if everybody agrees that our current path is leading to disaster, but I think there's a general underlying, I'm being Jungian, I think there's a sense in the psyche where we've got a certain view that there's a problem. Not that people maybe are expressing it in the terms that I am, but that things are starting to break down. A certain kind of way that we've been living is starting to show signs of splitting at the seams. I mean, but I'm going to back out of that because when we deal with history, it's his story, isn't it? There isn't one way to understand history. And in a way, as soon as you start to make predictions about our civilization is unsustainable, well, that's just a speculation, isn't it? and that'll become clear if it all does fall apart in some way or other. But my reading of things, I'd rather not say what's going to happen to our civilization. I'd like to point out that what we know in physics, the physicists have reached a point where they understand, if you like, that our 17th century conception of how things work here just isn't how it really is at a deeper level. And the physicists also understand that relativity theory and quantum theory are inconsistent with each other, and they haven't got the final picture either.
There's a unification theory they're looking for
sometimes. But, I mean, that knowledge of the inconsistency has been there since, you know, for decades. And that's not to say that physics won't come up with something, but at the same time, the physicists are dealing with a concept that we have, an ontology, putting it philosophically, of what kind of that we're living in a material universe, and that there's actually stuff out there, and if something's there, then it's there. It can't be there and somewhere else at the same time. There's a kind of a logic of the way that objects work for us in our perception that physics took and said that logic of a simplistic, materialistic, absolute space and time model of things, they took that and they projected that down into the microphysical level, and they found it doesn't work. Now, that's just one example of the way that we understand the way that we're living here collectively, which is quite simplistic, is inconsistent with our own science. So it's not as if when I'm talking about science and saying that science has determined how we see things, I'm really saying, well, no, actually, it's modern science doesn't have a clear view. We're lacking a kind of a collective view that can actually consistently hold together everything that we know, and that is the case. I don't want to predict doom and gloom for the future of our civilization. I'm just saying our civilization doesn't have a coherent. I mean, I'd almost like to say myth, because these things, in a way, these collective ideas that we have are sort of myths. It's not as if there is some ultimately correct view that you can take, I don't think. But you can take, you need, as a civilization to be healthy, I think you need to take a certain view that is at least consistent with what you already know. So part of this course is looking into the background of where the way that we do understand things comes from. And I want to look at ways in which we can, at this deeper philosophical level, ways in which that we can understand things so that we can make sense. I mean, essentially, putting it in another way, even more from a different direction, not thinking about physics, the deep problem with our culture is that at a certain point we said, okay, here's the material universe, that's reality, and our subjectivity in some sense is a kind of an imperfect expression of this deeper reality, and our subjectivity is not real in the way that the material universe is real. It's a sort of it's something subjective. And it's something to be put aside when we study what really is. Put aside in a way that David Eagleman expresses very well. Put aside in the sense that, if you remember Eagleman's conclusion, is that what we would call our phenomenological experience is a kind of a simulation of the real reality. It's not real reality, our actual experience. It's a sort of a simulation that our brains are producing, And behind that is the real reality. And the real reality, to quote him, it doesn't have any colour, for example. That's one of the points he wants to make in that documentary. So the arc of the course, and one of the reasons I didn't jump straight into the course is because the first reading I want to give you is so challenging that I wanted to just kind of give you a pep talk almost to sort of convince you that it's actually worth tackling this first reading, even though it may be heavy going, and it may be the case that you're going to have to wait until next week's class before I talk about it and we talk about it together before you start being able to put it together. Because the first reading I want to give you is Husserl's reading from The Crisis of the European Sciences about Galileo and what he calls the mathematization of nature. And this is Husserl's understanding of the what modern science is in its foundations. And the week after that, if we can deal with Husserl in 1 week, is I want to look at Heidegger's understanding of the foundations of modern science. And they consider the foundations of modern science to be Galileo and Newton, that era. And I want, instead of us just kind of talking vaguely about what science is, I do want to go into the founding ideas. And in a way, one way to appreciate what science is to kind of get a sense of that transformation that occurred between the medieval world and what we would call our modern scientific outlook, which in my interpretation of history, right, and it's important to understand that, I think we've been in that stream that was really created by some very acute intelligences that were there in the 16th and 1700s. We're still under the sway of those ideas. And just to round off what I was saying, I think we are potentially in a situation where, as a civilization, we are capable of a similar kind of paradigm shift. If we're not capable of it, I think, and this is my opinion, I think our civilization will fail. We're either going to have some kind of rebirth here, or somebody else is going to, you know, it's not a tragedy. We wouldn't still want to be under the Romans, would we? You know, a civilization like a human relationship. You know, things come to an end because of a kind of intransigence, you know, a failure to accommodate to what's actually happening. And I don't know. I see a certain signs of that intransigence, that sort of knowledge that we can't go on as we are, but we can't do anything about it. That's the sort of signal of a civilization that's in trouble. This is another deeper question. Well, what do you do in a situation like that? I mean, what's an appropriate response? I mean, for me, I guess my appropriate response for me is to deliver this course. You know, everybody's got their own response, right? But in a way, this course is a response to the kind of situation we find ourselves in, even though we're going to end up looking at a whole bunch of stuff to start with that was 700 years ago. I'd like you just to have this sense, it's not really several hundred years ago, it's actually still operating now. But for me, Husserl and Heidegger are doing a really excellent job of sort of lifting the carpet, lifting the of all the time that's grown on top, and looking under and saying, here's the origins, if you like, of the world that we're living in now, and if you can start to trace how they're operating now, it's very illuminating. So having said all that, I feel that was a big introduction, and I think we should have a little break. What do you think? I know it's only an hour, and it's shocking for me to say that, but I feel like that's the end of the introduction. After that, I'd like to just revisit some of the slides from that earlier course, because I've actually read through them, and I thought, well, they're not so bad. Because I originally wrote them probably 2-3 years ago now. And I never really go through them in detail, so let's see if I can actually go through my own slides. All right, so we'll have just a few minutes break now.